I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Just over a week ago, the week of the 11th, I spoke to Dr. Ralph Lewis. He's just written a new book, Finding Purpose in a Godless World, Why We Care Even If the Universe Doesn't. It's a fascinating book about the universe, faith, science, and how we view the meaning of life in a time of crisis. Dr. Lewis discusses the existential crisis he encountered once his wife was diagnosed with a serious illness. He discusses it in the book and in part with me in this interview you're about to hear. Near the end of the interview, I asked Dr. Lewis about suicide. Earlier that week, Kate Spade's death at her own hand was much discussed, and the day after we taped this, the news of Anthony Bourdain's death began more conversations on suicide. Ralph Lewis is a psychiatrist at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto, and a psycho-oncology consultant at the Odette Cancer Center. Visit his blog at health.sunnybrook.ca/finding-purpose. This new book is published by Prometheus Books. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Ralph Lewis. Dr. Lewis, good morning.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So I'll alternate between calling you Ralph and Dr. Lewis. You'll pardon my own my own habits. But Dr. Lewis, throughout human history, I guess people have always sought an explanation as to how this universe works, and most of the time, it's rooted in religion, isn't it?
I would say it certainly is.
I guess science and getting science to explain it to us. I mean, that's a relatively new phenomenon, isn't it?
Yes, probably the last four centuries. For most of those centuries, most scientists were themselves religious, and science was not necessarily directly challenging religious beliefs.
What are some of the questions that you get in terms of your work every day? I mean, I guess one of the ones that I'm going to ask you later is why people do bad things. But I guess people want to know whether the universe is random, is my assumption correct that a lot of people ask you that?
Well. I'm not sure they're asking me, assuming that I have any answers for them, but they're asking themselves or they're asking rhetorically. Certainly a very common question is, why is this happening to me? Why am I having such adversity? Why me? Is there a reason? What am I supposed to learn from this?
And I guess when we ask why me, we want an answer to whatever problem it is that we're contending with, right?
Right. And I should have added to my last point, of course, sometimes where that leads is, what did I do to deserve this? Did I somehow cause this? It's a very common question, why me?
I mean, that's something that you probably asked yourself, because you talk in the book about the cancer diagnosis that your wife Karen got a number of years ago. Were those? It's a question that a lot of us would ask, and I'm wondering you, because you're a doctor. Is that something that you also had to deal with?
I very quickly took my cue from Karen because some people did ask her that. They framed it as, do you find yourself asking why this happened to you? Do you find yourself asking why me? And Karen's a very matter-of-fact kind of person, and almost without thinking, her answer was, well, why not me?
Mm. And I guess that comes from her own... personality, in that she probably thought that she could deal with it as well as she could, right?
Yes, but also that she was a less spiritually inclined person to begin with than I was at that stage. And by the way, we're talking about 13 years ago, almost. Yeah, she just thought it was a nonsensical question. I didn't necessarily. I wasn't sure what I thought of that question, you know, why me? But she thought it was nonsensical because in her mind, there isn't any reason, if you'll pardon the expression, should happen. Mm. You know, and it happened to her, and why should she be exempt or immune? She didn't have any reason to think that she would. She knew that. She knew the statistics that cancer, including and especially breast cancer, which is what she had, is very common, and she just didn't expect that it shouldn't happen to her.
Now, you mentioned your own ideas, your own whatever conception you might have had about religion, and the difference that you had and that your wife had. So what was it sort of in your household growing up? Were you always, say, an atheist, an agnostic? And I guess those two things are different, aren't they?
Yes. So I certainly wasn't always an atheist. I would say I did call myself agnostic for most of my adult life and really from my teenage high school years onwards. I am Jewish, and I was raised in a traditional Jewish household, that is to say, not highly religious, traditional as in, you know, a very common type of Jewish household, which is that we observed religious traditions. We would have a Sabbath dinner, mm-hmm. at which we would recite the blessings, as much for tradition, for the sake of tradition and culture and history and bringing the family together, as about any true underlying belief. Mm-hmm. We would have Passover seders, as they're called, you know, the traditional dinner with the retelling of the Exodus and mm-hmm. and the commentaries about it, and etc. Many festivals and holidays. I went to a religious day school for pretty much all of my schooling up to grade 12. Mm-hmm. And this was a liberal, that is to say, politically liberal school, certainly in terms of the secular studies, and religiously traditional. So it leaned towards Orthodox, but it was not, for those familiar with Jewish Orthodox, it was not black hat mm-hmm. and long coat Orthodox. It was, you know, modern Orthodox is what they would like to call themselves. And we were raised within and educated within that tradition. But I started questioning religion, I'd say, early in high school, and was skeptical, as were many, if not most, of my friends, yeah. skeptical of the more literal biblical beliefs in divine revelation and things like that, but I still was partial to the idea that there was some deep truth of a religious transcendent nature,
yeah.
and I was inclined to believe that the universe had inherent purpose and was at some level somehow not only intended but designed, and that there was some sort of abstract higher power, not a personal interventionist biblical God necessarily, but some sort of abstract higher power, maybe inherent in the laws of nature, or something along those lines.
And so how has that changed over the last, say, 13, 14 years, say?
Right, so I have become a convinced atheist in this time frame, and for a lot of reasons, many of which are the very research that went into what eventually became this book. I wasn't intending to write a book at first. I was reading and researching these big existential questions and scientific questions for my own interest.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I was motivated by the experience of Karen's cancer, and actually by several other things which don't come into the book because they're probably of less interest to the reader. But there were a lot of things motivating me around that time of my life to delve deeper. What I would say is that I did come to realize around that time, partly because of my reaction to her cancer and partly for other reasons, I came to realize that I held contradictory, inconsistent beliefs. You could say I was experiencing cognitive dissonance, the mental discomfort of holding contradictory beliefs and then realizing it. And in terms of my reaction to her cancer, what it was that I felt in the immediate aftermath of her diagnosis, a series of events happened that as we were accessing diagnostic and treatment services, and I was mostly the one, because I'm a doctor in a big hospital, I was the one trying to figure out where she should get treated right. And by whom. And let's just say we got exceedingly lucky after being exceedingly unlucky. So we were, of course, unlucky to have this cancer in the first place, for her to have this cancer and for this to be happening to us. But we were very lucky in a very almost seemingly unlikely way in accessing the best possible treatment and in the availability of certain treatments, certain drugs, that it almost seemed cosmically guided. Mm-hmm. I felt sort of in an eerie way cosmically guided. I never believed it with any kind of certainty, but I had that kind of vague feeling that things were happening for a reason and meant to be.
Yeah.
And then I started mistrusting that feeling, which was, it was not the first time in my life I'd had that feeling, and I think probably most of us have had that feeling now and then. But I had enough clinical experience to mistrust my subjectivity and to suspect that I was in denial and that I was being unrealistically optimistic. Because I had worked clinically with so many people where that was clearly the case, and you know, where the outcomes were terrible, and yet people believed that things were somehow going to be okay and happening for a reason. So I started to wonder about this natural human tendency to think that things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
And I started to think about how we think that way about the universe itself, that the universe happened for a reason, exists with inherent purpose, started seriously questioning that and wondering what the implications would be if, in fact, I was quite wrong about that and if, in fact, the universe was fundamentally 100% random.
It's fascinating to read your book because then you work through all of this, and I suggest to our whoever's listening to us to pick up the book because it I don't know if it'll change whatever thinking you might have as a reader, but you'll certainly it's an edifying read at that. Because you are a doctor, because you work in a hospital, a lot of this working out, if you will, for yourself. That's probably expected, but for a lot of people who don't have, say, your background with and the education that you have, may be fine with whatever, say, contradictory beliefs that they have, and so and I guess that's why people turn to religion, right? I mean, they're looking for answers, and so that's why they look to organized religion, especially for help or comfort. In reading your book, I find that there's a way that we all can interact better with one another, because there are people like you and there are people who are deeply religious. And so, you obviously don't think it's your job to, say, convert them to your way of thinking.
Certainly not.
Yeah. So how do we interact with one another? I mean, you must see people in your practice every day who are religious.
Yes, absolutely. I have many patients like very much and admire very much who are deeply religious from various faiths. So absolutely my job is not to convert or deconvert anyone. Mm-hmm. I, My job is to help people to cope and function better. And very often, actually, I find myself needing to help to prop up people's religious beliefs, even though they're completely the opposite of my own beliefs.
Mm.
But I do that when someone who is very religious is struggling, is in an existential crisis, and let's say depressed, and let's say perhaps increasingly socially withdrawn and isolated. And in the interest of helping that person to function better, I will encourage and urge people to reconnect with their religious community and congregation. I'm often urging people to return to church, for instance, if they are usually regular churchgoers but have become depressed and withdrawn and isolated. And in fact, I find myself in the position not infrequently of helping people make sense of why terrible things have happened to them within the framework of their belief. And I'm quite familiar with the very intelligent and intellectually sophisticated religious arguments for why bad things happen to people. And I sometimes help people by sharing those insights that I've read or been told by religious people, and some helpful metaphors that attempt to make sense of things within a religious framework. But the thing is that this this religious notion or spiritual notion, for people who call themselves spiritual but not religious, the notion that the universe and life and our lives are inherently purposeful, intended and meant to be a certain way. It is often comforting, but it's a double-edged sword. And I've unfortunately dealt with or tried to help many people where that belief was shattered and they were devastated because of the type of adversity that happened to them that was just so terrible and had no redeeming features. There was no silver lining, in other words. There was just no way they could even imagine, let alone convince themselves, that it was somehow meant to be and happened for some reason. The notion that the ultimate reason is not understandable to us, but there must be a reason. It's just the kind of thing that people could not accept. An example that people would be familiar with on a larger level, on a societal level, would be something like the Holocaust. How do you ever even begin to come up with an explanation or even an hypothesis about what higher purpose that could possibly have served and how that could possibly justify the immensity and intensity of suffering that people experience? There are many times when it breaks down, and then people are left grasping, and with nothing to support them, and bewildered and disoriented as their worldview falls apart.
Now, that bewilderment when trying to figure out what people are for or what the reason is to live, can that come from, say, the unreasonable expectations of other people, and how much of, say, the goal of or the purpose of life comes from whatever expectations there are from, say, no family members, but society at large.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question fully, but I think what I'm hearing you ask is some of that. Well, the bewilderment, as you said.
Yeah, or just there are expectations when you go through life. They start from your parents, and then very
expectations.
Yeah, and then very often they come from oneself, don't they? I mean, you have goals that you want to achieve in life,
and then so you're speaking about the sense of failure. to meet those expectations of parents and others and of oneself.
Yeah, society also puts a lot of say...
So certainly feelings of failure and disappointment, profound disappointment in one's life, in oneself, this is a common theme in my work. A lot of people really struggling with that. So it's not just adversity that happens to people through bad luck, or at least what I would view as bad luck. It's also adversity that comes to people seemingly from their own doing, or at least they would blame themselves and feel that they failed, and especially failed relative to the expectations you just spoke about of others and of themselves. And I guess part of the issue there is this question of, are these expectations realistic in the first place? And we do have a propensity as human beings to set unrealistic expectations for ourselves and others, and that is part of the problem. Unrealistic optimism, really.
I guess I've conflated the two, haven't I? I mean, the expectations that one might have for themselves or on others, I may have confused that with, say what the purpose of life is. Because a lot of people, I guess, look at it that way, don't they?
Yeah, that the purpose has to do with meeting certain goals and meeting certain expectations.
Yeah, that at the end of your life, you're to have done this, and this.
Right, yeah. Yes, that's right. And so I work with cancer patients quite a lot. And by the way, I got into that work motivated by my family's experience with cancer. It was about 5 years after Karen's diagnosis that I started actually working in that area myself. I still do a lot of other work more broadly in psychiatry beyond cancer work, but the cancer component is involves people diagnosed and treated for cancer, and also people who unfortunately are dying from cancer, and helping them with depression and anxiety, which of course, as you might imagine, is common. And it's not universal, mind you, interestingly, but it's common among people experiencing severe cancer. So, there's an example where people, first of all, ask why me, as we were discussing previously, and try to make sense of this experience. But also, to this issue you just raised, are often confronted by their feelings of not having yet accomplished their perceived expected purpose in life. And so they had all these expectations, and they imagined that they still had time, maybe lots of time, to fulfill these purposes that they expected and hoped of themselves, or others expected and hoped for them. And now they may be faced with a foreshortened future, and the bitter disappointment and feelings of failure sometimes for not having achieved one's goals, and now having run out of time.
Now the idea, Dr. Lewis, about what really matters to people, I mean, one gets a sense of that urgently when faced with say, a terminal illness or a diagnosis, a serious diagnosis. Rather than ask you what you think really matters for people, is what matters to you, say, different than what would matter to me?
I'm sure that there are many differences, what matters to me, to you, and many people. But if we zoom out, I would say that the commonality is that what matters to people is that they matter, that they should matter, that their lives should matter to others, really, to the world, or their world, and their micro world, right? Mm-hmm. People have a deep need to matter. The worst thing that can happen to someone is to live their life and then be confronted with a foreshortened future and knowing that they're going to die soon, and to feel that it never mattered that they were here. It never mattered that they existed, that they lived their life, that people either didn't notice or care, or that they failed to do anything significant that would matter to other people. And so there are people, unfortunately, who live such lives where they really have felt that they failed terribly to achieve anything of significance, and for their life to have an impact on other people, and especially people who are angry and alienated and alienating, you know, who've burned bridges and relationships, etc. And you can imagine trying to help someone like that who's now dying of cancer, you know, as a professional caregiver. What does one say to someone like that? To help mitigate their suffering, you know, so actually I work with hospital chaplains. I teach hospital chaplains, religious chaplains. And we work together trying to figure out how to do exactly that, the challenge I just posed, which you can imagine as a worst-case scenario, you know, the most difficult case that they or I would encounter. We're asked to see such a patient, patient's dying, and patient's life has been a failure, patient is socially isolated of their own doing because they're kind of difficult, angry, alienating people, right? Mm-hmm. And so the religious chaplain would fall back on tools, you know, like, you know, religious tools trying to give the person a higher sense, you know, a sense that there's a higher purpose, that God has a plan even for them, that there's an afterlife, that there are more chances, you know, that God works in mysterious ways, and, you know, it all makes sense somehow, you know, in the end, whatever that is, you know, the heavenly view. But what if this person is a non-believer? So the chaplains are at a loss to know, how would we even... They wouldn't approach that person in the first place. Probably the person wouldn't accept talking to them. But I'm actually working with them to persuade them that they already know how to do this very well without the God talk and the afterlife talk and the everything happens for a reason talk. And they actually, there is a chance they could help such a person if they could persuade such a person to talk with them. And so how would they do that? How would I do that? If there's any chance at all to help someone in that worst case scenario, it would be by expressing and demonstrating deep interest in that person, deep empathic interest. I approach such a patient, if they'll let me talk with them, by saying to such a person, by asking such a person, first of all, permission, you know, may I talk with you? May I have a conversation with you? I really want to hear and learn about your experience. I want you to tell me, I want you to teach me about your life, about the life you've lived, about your frustrations and your regrets and your anger, about everything as much as possible. Please, may I sit here and listen to you for a while and hear everything you can tell me about your life, because I'm deeply interested. I really need to and want to know more about you. And the reason I want to do that is because I want to learn as much as possible from you and your life experiences, because I think you have a lot to teach me about life itself. And the lessons I learn from you, I want to take those lessons and apply them to my life, and I want to also transmit them to others. I work with many other patients, and I also teach many students of many kinds. I'm going to be a vehicle, a vector, to transmit your life lessons and your life story to others, and that is going to impact others, and it's going to impact me. So please, may I have your permission to listen to you and hear as much as possible, and may I come back another time and talk some more with you.
And very often, Ralph, that does work, doesn't it? That they're willing to speak. And I guess this is my idea of it, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that we live in a society where people are starved for contact, that they want some connection.
Yes. And so at the point of this all, at the point of this anecdote, because by the way, you know, these are worst-case scenarios. Like, most people's lives are not as terrible as that.
Yeah.
And there's more to work with. And, you know, the people do actually have some legacy that they can be proud about and feel some accomplishment about. And people have had an impact in this world, in this life. But the larger point I want to make is that if there is an ultimate way of defining purpose and meaning, and I'm not attached to the idea that there is. I think there are many purposes and meaning. But if we're looking for some all-encompassing statement, it would be that people need and want to matter, and the religious impulse is to want to matter to the universe. That the universe cares that we are here, right? And the subtitle of my book is Why We Care Even If the Universe Doesn't. And so it's about, the title is Finding Purpose in a Godless World. It's about how and why we have evolved as humans to care about our own lives, our own sense of purpose, and to care about other people and to have a coherent sense of morality and ethics. How all of this came to be, how all of it evolved in a universe that really doesn't care, that is indifferent, and where purpose isn't or wasn't a thing to begin with, right? So there's a larger question in the book, which is how did purpose even become a thing in a random, spontaneous universe? And how did complexity of all kinds emerge and evolve, literally initially out of nothing and through unguided self-organizing processes? Is that even plausible? And the short answer, science tells us, yes, it is, astonishingly and counterintuitively.
There's one thing I want to ask you, and I'm talking to you the week. Later in the week, earlier in the week, we got the news that Kate Spade took her own life, committed suicide. Someone asked me to ask you about that, a friend of mine, because they were wondering if the taking of one's own life is at all, say, I don't know how to put this, but is it at all explainable in terms of, say, addressing one's place in the world, I don't know, I guess, where are we in terms of the cultural, not acceptance, but where we are in terms of suicide itself? I mean, is it at all justified?
Well, there is such a thing as rational suicide, and in Canada, of course, we have medically assisted suicide.
The right to die, yeah.
In dying. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually quite involved in that as well. It's a part of the work I do as a psychiatrist working with cancer patients. So I'm called on every now and then to help with capacity assessments to assess whether such a decision is rational, or is this person's judgment clouded by, say, depression? You know, and what does that even mean, right? And when is it rational? When is it reasonable? When is it not? But on the other hand, wearing my other hat as a general psychiatrist, a lot of the work I do involves suicide prevention, and where necessary, sometimes making decisions for a person paternalistically, benevolently, in their best interests, you know, committing someone to hospital involuntarily, against their will, because to protect them from themselves if they are suicidal in an irrational way. So it seems like a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a contradiction. One has to take a very careful look at, you know, a person's values and motives and circumstances. But, you know, the famous existential philosopher and writer Albert Camus, around the Second World War and afterwards, wrote, you know, that suicide is the only truly serious philosophical question, you know, because deciding whether life is or is not worth living, you know, is the ultimate philosophical question. But part of what I've come to realize in my work, and I write about this in the book, is that the wish to die by suicide is very often, much of the time, caused by abnormal states in the brain. Mm. We're talking about depressive illnesses and other conditions that should be obvious. They're counter to the survival instinct. We naturally and normally, any healthy person with a healthy brain naturally has an appetite for life, an appetite to live, in the same way, in an analogous way to how we have an appetite to eat. Right. We just want to eat. We don't need to justify it. We don't intellectualize it or rationalize it. We desire to eat. And if you've ever lost your appetite because of being unwell, and not necessarily from nausea and vomiting, but just a pure loss of appetite, but as a result of some illness, you know what it's like then to lose, in an unnatural way, to lose that natural instinctive appetite and to have to force yourself to do something that no longer feels like it has a point. It feels pointless. It feels effortful. It's unpleasant. You have to eat, right? So depression as an illness is like that. It's like losing your appetite, but more broadly for activities, for life itself. Everything feels pointless and effortful. Yeah. But in the context of medical assistance in dying, it's a very different situation, and that's usually not motivated by a distorted view. It can be very, very rational.
Yeah, and I guess for a lot of people, that's why people are uncomfortable talking about it, is they think it's the same thing.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And I guess most people who are opposed to, say, the right to die, in a religious, context, will use that as to buttress
their argument. Yeah, that's right. And actually, the people I've worked with who requested and in many cases proceeded to medical assistance in dying, these were people who were not necessarily depressed at all at the end of their life. Many of them were able to adopt a celebratory attitude to their life in those last days and even last minutes, you know, expressing how much their family and friends mattered to them, and their friends and family express how much this individual who's about to die, you know, has mattered to them in turn. And, you know, some wonderful conversations take place when someone is scheduled for medical assistance in dying. Some very deeply meaningful conversations and a lot of joy and happiness and laughter, sometimes food and wine as well, you know, the celebratory last meals. It's interesting what people do, and music.
Yeah.
And, you know, people feel that their life, very often, they feel their life has been well worth living, has been very meaningful, has definitely mattered, but now they want to end it on their terms, and they consider further suffering from, let's say, cancer to be futile. And it's a very rational decision for many people.
And for a lot of people, I mean, just speaking for myself, I mean, it seems like a marvelous clarity to have at whatever point in one's life, it's at the end of one's life that you're able to be in that place that you just described.
Yes, I would say it is.
Yeah.
Of course, there have been many legitimate concerns, very understandable concerns about the slippery slope
right.
that everyone fears, you know, and people have you know, strong memories, or societal memories at any rate, of, you know, Nazi euthanasia and things like that. It's for very good reason that society hesitated for a very long time before mm-hmm. getting to this point, and that there are many safeguards that we ought to insist are in place. But it actually is, I've certainly become convinced that it, the Supreme Court of Canada made the right call on this. It was very rational, and I've seen it now implemented in extremely meaningful ways. And on the very same day as I am involved in a case like this, I will still be involved with another person who has abnormally, unnaturally lost their appetite for life, suffering from a depressive illness, and who is irrationally trying to end their life. And I will benevolently and paternalistically intervene on that person's behalf in their better interests to protect them from themselves and prevent them from suicide.
We're fascinating creatures, aren't we? This book, from what I've read of it, I mean, it's just started such a necessary conversation in our society. And I suspect, Ralph, you'll help a lot of people with this book. A lot of people that pick this up will get something out of it. I've so enjoyed talking to you today, and I've been looking at the clock now and realize that it's just whizzed by. I could spend another 40 minutes with you. There's just a great deal to talk about. I so appreciate your time, though.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I so appreciate the invitation and opportunity and your interest.
The website for more, PurposeWithoutGod.com. The book is called Finding Purpose in a Godless Universe, Why We Care Even If the Universe Doesn't. Prometheus Books is its publisher. Dr. Ralph Lewis, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.